You're dialed in at 89.1 KHOL. I am here with biologist and author Douglas Chadwick on his new book, Tracking Gobi Grizzlies. He will be talking at the Center on February 12th, From Gobi Bears to Greater Yellowstone Grizz, an evening of adventure, science, issues, and conservation. The book signing is at 5:30, and the program will begin at 6:30. Douglas, thanks for coming by KHOL today.
Hey, you bet. Glad to be here.
So I'm just going to start by asking you, what are the main differences between North American grizzlies and the Gobi grizzly?
Grizzly bears are worldwide in the Northern Hemisphere, and I've run into grizzly bears in Russia, in the Himalayas at 17,000 feet, you know, Northern India, there are some in Syria, and turns out there are some in the Gobi Desert. Now, compared to our bears, they are, as you could imagine, with an animal that lives in a place where it's 120 degrees in the summer, 40 below in the winter, and kind of a one huge half-million-acre rockscape with a little sand thrown in here and there. They're not as big as our bears. And they're lean, they're rangy-looking, but otherwise they're very much a grizzly. They look very familiar to those of us who hang out with grizz, and certainly their attitude, that kind of indomitable nature, is really on display when you handle them in traps and then release them. And we were putting satellite radio collars on them, and I remember watching these bears try to back off of two vans full of, you know, big people and gear 8 feet tall, and they just keep coming. And I'm like, I don't care, I'm a grizzly bear.
So can you talk a bit about the overall environment that is the Gobi Desert?
First of all, it covers the southern third of Mongolia and a big whack of north-central China. And it gets 2 to 4 inches of rain a year. It gets to be way sub-zero in the winter. And it gets 122 degrees, I think, is the maximum temperature. Look, I ended up writing a book about a bear nobody's ever heard of, in a place hardly anybody knows. And that would have included me a few years ago. And I thought of the Gobi, when I bothered to think of the Gobi, as, you know, like the Sahara, or I just thought it was a big stretch of drifting sand. And it turns out it's a rugged mountain area, and it's more a rockscape, is what I call it. It's wind-scoured, it's heavily eroded. It's dissected into a maze of canyons and ridges and a place you can get lost in just by turning around three times if you're not keeping track. So it's a stingy kind of environment, and yet the amazing thing was to see how many big animals have managed to find a way to live in this place. And that would include most of the world's double-humped wild camels. It has wild asses. It has wolves. It has snow leopards, black-tailed gazelles, ibex. Argali, wild sheep, is also the last home of Gobi bears, about 30 to 40, maybe a little more, a little less. I said, in the world? And they said, yes. And I've got to go see these things, and maybe there's some way can help them.
So that brings me to my next question. How do you describe the relationship between the Mongolian people and the Mazalai, what they call the Gobi bear?
Look, Mongolia's the least populated large country in Asia. And there's probably 3 million people in a really big nation. And half of them now live in the capital city of Ulaanbaatar. And I'd say they know about as much about Gobi bears as we do about jaguars. They've heard of it. You will see Mazalai vodka for sale, and you can even buy Mazalai bread. But I don't think they give it much thought. And the other reason it wasn't well known in Mongolia was simply that there's nobody in this part of the Gobi where the bears are. Just too tough, and there's not enough water to support communities of people. So I'm sure the locals, such as there are around the Gobi, a few scattered herders here and there on the fringe. I'm sure they had heard about the bear, but it was confused with the Mongolian version of Bigfoot or Sasquatch or the Yeti. And it wasn't until 1943 that science was able to confirm that these things even exist. So the Mongolians can be forgiven for not knowing a lot about Gobi bears in the past, but since the Gobi Bear Project started in 2005, there's been a real effort to increase awareness of this area, and they declared 2013 the year of the Gobi Bear in Mongolia.
But you worked with some Mongolian biologists as well.
Yeah, and that's the great part of it. I mean, it's their bears, and you know, nobody likes foreigners coming in and saying, look, I've been to a fancy university in the States. Let me tell you what to do. The Mongolians know that country. I've learned a ton about the desert from the rangers I work with and with the scientists from the Mongolian University. And they've opened my eyes, and they're the ones that want to make this happen. And they're the ones that invited some people with expertise from North America to come over and help them. How do we keep these bears?
That brings up my next question. Local Jackson biologist and conservationist John and Frank Craighead pioneered groundbreaking research that helped make the North American grizzly bear a success story. Do you think that their work can translate over to help save the Gobi bear?
There's a direct connection from the Craigheads' groundbreaking work in the greater Yellowstone area to Gobi bears. And not only the information the Craigheads pioneered, but the fact that Harry Reynolds, who is the chief investigator on the Gobi Bear Project and was head of the International Bear Association for a couple of terms, when he was a teenager, started working for the Craigheads down in Yellowstone. Harry was capturing bears, collaring them along with the Craigheads when all this was brand new and radio collars were still a recent invention. And he went on to work in Alaska for decades as a bear manager. And as I say, he was in the International Bear Association, and they said, we need someone we can absolutely trust to handle these rarest of bears. So a student of the Craigheads is now in charge of trying to save the world's rarest bears.
So this is the rarest bear in the entire world. There's somewhere between 3 to 4 dozen of them left. Are the resources and energy that it's going to take to turn around this bear species, is that worth the time putting in?
And that's something certainly we all ask ourselves. But look, almost two-thirds of the world's large mammals are rare, threatened, or endangered today. And 90% of the, you know, the living weight or biomass of large animals with backbones on the planet are in trouble. Humans and their livestock have monopolized most of the globe. And so if you're looking, it doesn't pay to be big anymore if you're a wild animal. So the bear, in a way, is, to me, a symbol for a whole lot of creatures. And the fact that there are very few makes it a risky business. But the one thing I want to get across is that these bears are stable to slightly increasing. That's what we found over the years. We get photos at camera traps set up at oases of babies, newborn babies. They're doing their job. They're making more of themselves. If we're responsible for there being so few, we should be responsible for helping them get back on their feet. And it looks like we can. We got a chance. I just found it impossible to, all of us found it impossible to turn our backs and walk away and say, look, the way this pencils out, we should be doing something else. It's like, no, we're going to stay here and we can do this.
Doug, thank you so much for stopping by KHOL and talking about the Gobi Grizzly with me.
Thanks very much, Brennan.
Once again, that was author and biologist Douglas Chadwick, and he is going to be speaking at the Center for the Arts on February 12th at 6:30 p.m. This has been KHOL, Jackson. Mm-hmm.